Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to thank members of the fire service who are on the front lines every day championing fire sprinklers at the grassroots level. We are all truly indebted to your service.
Well, this is Shane Ray. I'm acting as the moderator today in the podcast brought to you by the National Fire Sprinkler Association. And I have a group of panelists with us today that are quite distinguished in the field of fire service, for sure, and we're going to talk about community fire protection and firefighter line of duty deaths, and where's the solutions, so what's the problems, and those kind of things. So we should have an interesting conversation today. We've got with us the panelists. We have Chief Alan Brunicini, of course, needs no introduction, the retired fire chief out of Phoenix, Arizona. Chief Dennis Rubin, he's our nation's fire chief now at the Washington, D.C. Fire Department. We have Chief Sean DeCrane of the Cleveland Fire Department and our IAFF representative to the code world, if you will. We have Chief John Buckman, the fire chief in German Township, Indiana, past president of the IFC, and Bob James with the regulatory services of Underwriters Laboratory. So, hello, guys. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you.
Doing good, Shane.
Thanks for having me here, Shane.
All right. We'll get right into this. If you'd like to take a few minutes here and say a few words, we'll start with Chief Brunicini to get us started. If you got a few words you'd like to say.
Sure. Thanks for including me, Shane. Good morning to the rest of the panelists here. Nice to be with you. I think obviously a significant subject for us is both the protection of the physical plant, and I think obviously sprinklers are a huge part of that. And along with that, I think probably the biggest issue inside our service is simply the welfare of our members. And it seems as though that beat goes on in a frustrating kind of way. There's a lot of people trying to reverse it, and it's a pretty difficult task for us. We're dealing with about 11 generations of momentum in us delivering service in a way that really does not protect the members who are going into that hazard zone. So I guess there's certainly plenty of work for us to continue to do. So I think it's timely that we get together and try to make sense out of it.
Good. Thanks, Chief Brunicini. Chief Rubin?
Hey, sir. Good morning. Let me say a thank you to the National Fire Sprinkler Association. What a great podcast they're putting together, and always the great work of Firehouse.com. We appreciate getting information out to everybody in our business. It's just amazing. I know prior to going to air, we had spoken a little bit about the Loudoun County firefighters. Well, there happened to be in a burn unit, all three of them, in our city. Prior to those folks being in that burn unit, there were three Montgomery County firefighters in the same burn unit, probably in the same bed. And if you go back a few, 4 or 5 months ago, we happened to have three firefighters who were knocking on death's door. In all three cases, the homes were not sprinklered. The firefighters followed policy and procedure as best we could tell, but yet we ended up with injuries to such a degree that almost put them out of commission, and I mean permanently, not just their jobs. We have the technology at our fingertips. It's time for us, the leaders of our business, to start to see if we can't bring about that change where sprinklers become an everyday part. I'm just amazed in the two cases, the one in Montgomery County, which I'm familiar with, and the one in Loudoun County, relatively new homes, lightweight construction, both reach flashover. One, a staircase burns through in Montgomery. In Loudoun, essentially, a flashover occurs on the top floor. Members are at huge grave danger. In our city, the home was a little older, but still retro capability of sprinkler systems, such as in like the wonderful home that Chief Brunicini lives in, is something that we should be striving towards.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Good points, Chief Rubin. Chief DeCrane?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Shane. I agree with what's been said already by Chief Brunicini and Chief Rubin. You know, for years and years, we've been taught to be aggressive as firefighters and get in and put the fire out quickly and not necessarily recognizing the danger we're putting ourselves and our members into. With the construction practices nowadays and also the building contents that we're using nowadays, the fire ground is becoming even more dangerous. And we go to a lot of training sessions where we start to formulate training exercises how to deal with the changing environment. And I like to put a little bit more effort, instead of being reactionary, to be proactive. Proactive in the codes aspect of we can become proactive and make our work environment safer, such as the requirement of sprinklers or the protection of lightweight construction or some of the construction practices that are ongoing. Those are the things that we can affect change. For a relatively small investment, we can have a huge reward.
Good. Thank you, Sean. Chief Buckman, how about a volunteer's perspective?
I think, again, I want to thank Firehouse for having us here. I think the National Fire Sprinkler is one of the leaders trying to push the fire service along. As most of us know, we are very steeped in tradition, and sometimes we have to have outside influences to push us. I think some of the issues are with the increase in the size of homes being built in suburban, rural, and even remote areas creates a new challenge for that volunteer, even small paid fire department in having an adequate amount of apparatus and staff to extinguish that fire that may occur in a rural or remote area. So I think this is an appropriate time to have this discussion. And glad to be here.
Thank you, Chief Buckman. We have Bob James with us with UL. I know there's an exciting program. We're looking at firefighter safety in the modern environment. We're going to be in a meeting on that here pretty soon. Bob?
Yeah, thanks again for inviting me. I'm humbled to be here among all you distinguished guests. And as a non-fire service a person, I was surprised at the request to have me available, but I appreciate that. As most of you know, UL has been actively involved in the past over 100 years worth of fire safety and emission safety is a focus of ours. And as Chief Fraser pointed out, we're under currently some grant investigation into some of the firefighter safety issues, and one being trust. Development and trust, just fire reaction, I guess, is probably the best way to say it. And again, I think a lot of us intuitively have some ideas on what this means and the construction features of the past and how we're doing it today. But I think the needed thing was to have a independent review and get some statistics, get some laboratory experience in the construction field, and see what happens. And we're in the middle of that process. We've done a number of tests. I think none of the tests are a surprise, but right now it's data crunching time. We have sheets and sheets and video and all kinds of instrumentation that was taken during the test, and now it's time to sit down and see what that means. Is it really something we can do? And then the future holds is, I guess, like we mentioned earlier, maybe some code changes, maybe some different approaches, maybe the SOPs need to change. But those are things that are coming down the line once we figure out what the data says. So the next 2 days we're going to be meeting and trying to give some focus to that so we can get a report to the DHS for the grant. So again, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Bob. Well, I know this is one of the things I know this is going to be no shock to any of you all. We've got a great start here. But as I sit here today reading headlines and reports, and as Chief Rubin has already talked about the recent events of firefighters, I sit here and find myself a little confused. I read the firehouse headlines and find things such as 6 firefighters hurt in a blaze, firefighter critically burned in flashover, firefighter succumbs to injuries. I have all these NIOSH reports looking at and reviewing them. We find that I think what we see here is that from 97, when you look at the NIOSH line of duty death reports all the way through 2007, it appears that the number of firefighter line of duty deaths specific to residential occupancies is up. Yet I read reports here from, let me just say, our non-fire service experts that say fires are at an all-time low. Fire deaths, especially in house fires, have fallen dramatically. And they also look at and say new homes aren't our problem. Yet I look at these headlines, and many of these houses were built within the last 20 years. I know we had a line-of-duty death here in Tennessee that the house was built in 2004. So there's a multifaceted approach, I think, to a very complex problem that's not really new to us. And so that's where I wanted to start with the Chief Brunicini here. And you've been committed, Chief, to firefighter health and safety for decades. I guess we should look at how we get firefighters to fire chiefs to truly understand what this risk management really is. I know it took many years for me to have that value shift, if you will. So how do we get firefighters and fire chiefs to see that, and how do fire sprinklers help us address some of those issues?
Well, Shane, I think, and you set the stage for it, is that if you look at the statistics, the category of firefighter, particularly fatalities, that is getting worse, are tactical deaths. Because I think that all the other categories are either holding their own or actually getting better. But when we look at sending firefighters into a hazard zone, and a lot of it's already been said here this morning, is that if we haven't identified the standard management categories that it takes for us to create regular operations that are survivable in the environment that we're involved in. And that environment is changing now. You've said it. We're applying 1940 tactics to 2008 buildings that are lightweight. They have different structural components. They're insulated in a different way. The air conditioning dynamics of them were completely different. The arrangement of them has changed so much. If you look at particularly the houses, single-family residents anymore are like old commercial buildings. And I think Chief Buckman said it, is all of us are going to 5,000-7,000 square foot single family, one and two story multiple level occupancies that are just absolutely fatal when they're burning. And it's not only the construction of them, but the arrangement of them. If you look at the way they deliver truss packages, they're in three trucks, and there aren't four trusses that are the same size. So you look at the tactical operations in those buildings. Are incredibly complex. I think from the standpoint of us trying to package up from a fire chief standpoint and then down through to the people who are actually going in that hazard zone, some kind of a program that we can make sense out of, and I think it's a 30-year-old model, is that if we can establish in the beginning that some standard operating procedures that describe, again, the operational realities of where we're going out and delivering service, in other words, where we have to do a better job of defining that. Now, it would seem as though, for example, the work that the underwriters are doing ought to be integrated, because it is the most modern investigation into those environments. But if we can't translate those into standard operating procedures, it becomes really difficult for us to execute that when we have to go out and actually operate on the fire ground. Our training needs to hook up to that. In other words, our training needs to be relevant in the sense that it matches what those procedures are that have been developed and defined and somehow created in a way that matches what we're actually having to do. Then we go out, and Chief Rubin mentioned the saddest part of it, is if you look at the thermal insult that our people are going through right now, is absolutely incredible, and the burn units are full. I mean, Chief Rubin and I have been blabbing about this, what, Dennis, for the last 25 years?
Chief, at least.
Yeah, and it isn't getting any better. In other words, we are putting firefighters into environments that simply are sadly not survivable in the process. I think in the way that we review that, and I think that's what we're doing here today, is critical to us. In other words, that we have to make adjustments in the way that we operate, and almost now, I won't say minute-by-minute basis, but it seems like it is exactly that. And then if we can't revise the way that we operate, and I think, again, a lot of the traditional tactics that we use, it will be sound for the next 150 years, but there's a lot of it that simply is hurting us and killing us. Now, when you start translating that into, let me just say, a command system, and I'm not going to give you a big command lecture, But if we don't have a management system on the fire ground, on that incident site, to somehow be able to develop and internalize and react to the hazards that we're dealing with in a realistic, survivable kind of way, we're going to keep killing ourselves. Now, obviously, when you start looking at that, it starts to describe the art of the possible tactically. And that's where sprinklers come in, is that we have a lot of fairy tale perceptions of what we can do and what we can't do. I hate to say that about us. And there are simply a lot of situations now that manual fire suppression is simply, it has such a narrow range of offensive opportunities that we have almost eliminated its effectiveness. So from that standpoint, necessarily, and I'm kind of backing into it, there's 100 other reasons why we ought to do it, that if we can't build that protection into that piece of property, it is absolutely unrealistic to think that manual fire suppression is going to do it, particularly when you get into those larger areas, those hazard zone areas that are larger. Now, again, we used to think of them as commercial buildings, but as I've already said, we're starting to see those same areas in residential applications in the process. So necessarily, if we can't build that protection in, that is pre-action, that is, in other words, those it is the only form of protection that is absolutely automatic. And it's automatic when it should be, where it should be, and it does just exactly what it needs to be done. And simply, and I don't mean this disrespectfully to firefighters at all, but firefighters simply are not a substitute for sprinkler protection. Manual fire suppression is the end of the fire protection chain. It's the most desperate, dangerous, and the least effective way for us to protect people and property.
I've heard you before, Chief Brunicini, describe home fire sprinklers as home CPR. I thought that was interesting.
Well, you mentioned it, Shane. I watched a Phoenix Ladder Company on a roof of a house one day, and I went home and sprinkled my house. You ain't going to do that to my kitchen.
Yeah.
So, and they were a fine ladder company, too.
Yeah. Chief Bugman, I know you and I have talked about him. While I was fortunate to work for Chief Brunicini as an intern, so I got to experience that side of the house, but with your blame or credit for my National Fire Service involvement, I know we've talked about before the capabilities of the fire department, that maybe mine and your fire departments are very different than Sean in Cleveland or Chief Brunicini in Phoenix or certainly D.C., Chief Rubin in D.C., you want to elaborate on those capabilities and things we've talked about?
Sure, Shane. Thanks. I think, and Chief Bernicini has said it just a couple minutes ago, and when you start talking about or looking at the size of the structure, the size of the residential structure without sprinkler protection, 5,000, 11,000, or even bigger, if it was a commercial occupancy, it would be sprinklered, and it would be required to be sprinklered by the code. And whether you're a small fire department or a large fire department, what are you used to fighting? You're used to fighting a fire in maybe a 2,000-square-foot house, a mobile home, a garage, and you start thinking and start applying the tactics to that 5 or 11,000-square-foot house, and it, in many cases, gets us in trouble. And the fires that we've just talked about, whether it was Loudoun County or D.C. or Prince William County, Virginia, or we'll go to Evansville, Indiana, where we had one about 2 years ago. It was a 8,000-square-foot log cabin where flashover occurred, and the guys at the front door, fortunately, were still outside the front door when it occurred instead of being about 10 foot inside that building, or we'd be having guys probably still in burn wards today. Or in one case in Indiana here where a small fire department happened to be all volunteer staffing, rode up to a fire in an 11,000-square-foot house. Again, if these were commercial occupancies, these would be sprinklered. But because they're residential occupancies, they are not. And I think fire departments need to be aware of their capability. Can they effectively manage an incident in that size of structure? Are they capable of doing that? Do they have the right mindset? Do they have the right resources? I think is a huge challenge that all fire departments are facing.
Certainly, and that's certainly a task. I know some of those big structures, we've have all of us have them in our districts, but I'm like, sometimes we have to have a tagline to get out of them on a medical call, let alone in a zero visibility environment.
Certainly. I mean, when you start thinking about, how do you go into a house that is 11,000 square feet? Do you know your way around? Could you find your way around? It's not many commercial occupancies are not cut up like an 11,000 square foot house. You start talking about your firefighters' capability, whether or not they can go inside and do offensive suppression operations, perform a primary search, secondary search, and do all those things in a rapid manner in which they're used to doing it on a mobile home fire. The risk to firefighters is outrageously dangerous, and firefighters need to recognize that danger.
And I think I heard you tell a humbling story on that, about that incident, particularly where you had the loss of life, from the firefighter, about a citizen maybe connected to the firefighter or the owners of the house that asked, why were we in there?
I actually, the firefighter who died here in Indiana in November of 2006, I came back. I was actually at Emmitsburg at the National Fire Academy and came back to Indiana to help in the debriefing process and the funeral planning. And I conducted a meeting with firefighters and family members, and I actually had a spouse of one of those firefighters who was not injured or killed get up in front of the room and ask me why these firefighters were inside. And here I am standing in front of about 125 people trying to think of some politically correct answer when I'm not sure there was a politically correct answer. But, you know, you don't want to beat the fire department up for decisions they made, especially with this catastrophic event. But, you know, again, the decisions that are made have consequences. It's much easier to get out of a mobile home fire because it's usually 6 feet to the door. But when you get in a large residential occupancy, it's a long way to a window or a door.
Thank you, Chief Buckman. Chief DeCrane, I know you're one of the biggest advocates for building and fire codes in the IFF, and certainly it's been a great partnership through this codes process. And I know you've became an advocate. I've heard you tell the story about being involved in the codes-making process. And as we talk about this built environment, I know the IFF has some proposals talking about protecting the lightweight construction and in these new structures, particularly homes and through the International Residential Code. Are we going to make it? Is there some possibilities here in the future for us to maybe overcome some of these standard management practices that Chief Brunicini talks about we can't get a hold of?
I think there is. And I mean, so much has just been said in the last 10, 15 minutes, trying to expound on it. I agree with everything that's been said, especially what Chief Brunicini has discussed about firefighter tactics. I know we were down at our training academy, and we were running through some RIT training, and one of our older firefighters, we're an old department. We haven't hired since 2001, so we have a very experienced department. And one of the comments that came back was, we don't need this type of training. We know how to fight house fires. And I looked at the individual, and my comment to him was, you may have learned how to fight the house fires from 60 years ago or 40 years ago, but you don't know what you're doing in today's house. And that's the kind of education we need to get out to the fire service that, you know, I think sometimes we read the newspapers and watch the TV commercials that talk about the hero status of firefighters, and our people have buy-in to that, and that's not a bad thing, but sometimes it clouds our judgment, and we believe we're made of Teflon and we're invincible. And there are a lot of questions of why were they in there? It's exactly as the chief was just talking about, standing in front of a group of people. Why were we in there? Was there life safety involved? You know, we also need to educate homeowners and potential homeowners that when they start to build houses out of this type of construction that has no protection integrated into it, and they're demanding lower taxes, so they're cutting fire department budgets and response capabilities, that they're building that house as large as they're willing to lose. And that if they get a house fire in that house with that open, wide floor plan and the lightweight construction and reduced response capabilities, they better expect to lose that house. That fire department's responsibility now just became make sure their neighbors aren't harmed also. And that's some of the education that needs to get out there. And if you sit there and ask a homeowner that just built their dream home, are you willing to lose that? Or if you put $5,000 to $7,000 into it, you can ensure that house is protected. We can protect your dream home. And you might get a better decision out of these homeowners.
See,
and I don't think so. Pardon me?
This is Brutus. Let me interrupt you just for a second, Steve. Could we say that those places burned down according to code?
That comment, those people died by the code? I've heard that being going out a lot. I mean, you go to those code hearings, Chief, and it simply comes down to cost. That is the argument constantly from the national home builders. It's about cost. In fact, the last cycle, and Shane, you may have been there, we simply, in the intent of the code, wanted to insert that the protection of firefighters and first responders would be in the intent of the code. And they actually argued against it. And why? It comes down to cost.
We got that in, though.
Yeah, we got it in. Yeah, but, you know, they stood at the microphone and said they were concerned about firefighter safety. And, you know, our reply was, you know, I don't doubt that. I'd just like to see it in writing. And the constant theme comes back to it's going to cost too much to build this house. You're going to put us out of business. Well, I don't buy that, really. You know, if a homeowner is educated on why it costs money, more times than not, that homeowner is going to make a good decision and say, okay, I agree with that.
Chief Rubin, you are known as a fire chief who understands the importance of prevention, especially in addition to fire ground strategy and tactics. And I know in Atlanta, you had made a strong push for to have residential sprinklers installed in Atlanta, probably closer than I've seen a metro city. Chief Brunicini certainly got it in Phoenix for the commercial, especially after Brett Tarver's death there. But what's your take on all this?
Well, and I think that's exactly where the discussion needs to go. Haven't had a chance to work pretty diligently with you and all of the folks in National Fire Sprinkler Association with Atlanta. There wasn't any firefighters that showed up in City Hall, but there was a lot of misunderstanding on part of the council members. And again, I think it was our fault for not educating them. And the mention of money, follow the money, was a really big deal. The biggest concern there was, even if it added another dollar to the cost of the home, affordable housing, low-income housing would slip out of the grasp of the folks who lived in the community. So I think that's something that we really have to look at. In the District of Columbia, we have really hit a major milestone here, and I know probably for most places this will be pretty small, but July 1st, 2008, our Fire Safe Cigarette Act takes effect. Next week, along with the mayor, we'll be announcing our second attempt to get control over public demonstration of fireworks. And obviously, our logical third step is to work pretty hard to bring about residential sprinkler protection and making it a requirement. But it really takes a lot of leadership. It really takes a lot of effort. It's risky. I think folks tend to get the ear of the council members who are in big business, who are worried about economic development, and we have to be able to send that message out in a way that's not threatening, that we're not going to take families out of their homes, that we're not going to force construction in other communities except for ours. And again, I just don't think we have led that charge in a structured way, with the exception of the Sprinkler Coalition and a couple of other groups that have been doing some tremendous work, Shane, along with your office. But very few people have gotten that message. Again, I don't see the rank-and-file firefighter showing up protesting, carrying signs saying, please don't sprinkler. I've heard several estimates that if we began today to sprinkle every building in America, it would take about 160 years to get that completed. And obviously, I think we would all get to go on plenty of fires in the meantime.
I think so. And Sean, don't you think we're making huge progress in that arena?
Shane, I think we're asking John Buckman that. I think we are making some progress. The fire service is a little more aware of code issues, but still the firefighter who is riding in the back seat of that engine company, they don't understand codes. They really don't care much about codes. But I think fire chiefs have become much more engaged in the code process in the last couple of years.
Chief DeCrane, I know we don't. Go ahead, Chief Ruben.
Well, Ruben again, and I think that's where we're going to make profit, is just doing exactly what Chief Buckman said, focusing on educating our elected officials, the political will of the nation, and developing a national policy that has, I'm hoping, incentives for sprinkler buildings. It's amazing. I got very close to buying a home here in the district, and when I asked about it being sprinklered, the disincentives were really substantial. As it turned out, I didn't put a down payment on the home. I'm still waiting to sell one in Atlanta. But bottom line is the cost to put a sprinkler package together in an existing home was pretty substantial. So instead of it costing, I think not only do we have to educate the politicians, and especially for retro now, I think we've got to develop incentives that gets the communities thinking about putting sprinkler systems in. I teased a little bit earlier about Chief Brunicini, but he has brilliant piping. I think he spends a lot of time polishing that brass pipe in his home, but it absolutely ends up being gorgeous. And bottom line is I just don't think we're selling the benefits. I don't believe we're out there enough in the communities. And, again, I'm hoping we can develop some incentives, and I don't know where the money will come from, but will cause people to think twice about either retroing or initially having their home sprinklered as they're being built. And I just don't see that leadership on a large-scale basis. I think Chief Buckman was right. We're getting better. And I also applaud his comment about the average firefighter doesn't really know much about what we're talking about.
Yeah, no. And one of the things, if I could interject here, too, is you're exactly right, and especially as I sit here and look at the things on Charleston and the firefighters killed in Salisbury, North Carolina this year already, in a commercial setting. The National Fire Sprinkler Association, in partnership with a lot of other folks in the American Fire Service, has the Fire Sprinkler Incentive Act. And I know Jim Dalton's been working on that hard for the last 5 years. We get a little bit closer every time. And so that would offer those places like Charleston or the mill work in Salisbury, North Carolina. If we could get that passed, it does offer incentives to depreciate the cost of the system over the course of 5 years instead of 39 and a half years. So that would be a huge incentive to help us with that.
You know, Shane, can I, this is Sean DeCrane here. Just go back to something Chief Buckman and Chief Ruben have touched on, and that is the firefighters' interest in the codes. And I agree that the interest hasn't been there, but going around now, I'm starting to see more of an interest from the suppression side. And one of the things I think we need to dispel a myth is that fire sprinklers will put the fire service out of business. You know, suppression is only about 7 to 10% of our actual duties. So sprinklers are not going to eliminate fires from occurring. They'll keep them in a manageable size, which then in turn will keep firefighters safe. When we were sitting at the IFF offices talking about the residential sprinkler issues, one of the things we were debating back and forth cost, you know, impact on suppression, those types of issues. But it came right down to it that sitting at that table, we could come up with firefighter after firefighter who had died in a residential structure would be alive today if residential sprinklers had been installed. Because the fire got unmanageable, they were in doing a search and rescue for life safety, and either a collapse or a flash occurred, which then compromised their safety and ended up killing them. And we haven't talked about the 81,000 firefighters that are injured every year and the cost impact on that. If we look at, NIST did a study on the economic impacts of firefighter injuries, and they looked at 1 year and about approximately 81,000 injuries. And they concluded that those lifetime costs for just those injuries would be 2.7 to 7.2, excuse my math for a little bit here, between $2 and $7 billion. Now, that's an economic incentive to reduce those numbers. And, you know, we have to educate the firefighters that this is about their safety and that getting involved in the codes can have a direct impact on the safety of their work environment, because the built environment is our work environment. The stations are only our staging ground.
I think if we were asked, the firefighter spouse, would they prefer sprinklers in residential occupancies? I think we all know the answer, and that would be yes. Because not only the financial impact on that firefighter or that community, but it's what's the family got to deal with. And, you know, if I know in the last couple of years that I've been pushing this, maybe as I get older and realize how important family is and look at my little granddaughter thinking, wow, if I wasn't here, I'm going to miss all the things that I get to experience with her and all the joy that she brings. If firefighters would just think about someone else, not just always about themselves, I think they would get involved in the code process, because they'll understand it. It's for their overall benefit, not just for to reduce the number of fires we have.
Yes, it's one of the things too here is I look at this firefighter. We've had 9 firefighter, direct interior operation fatalities in 2008 that I can account for so far. And one of the headlines, of course, the Charleston event is going to be obvious with some of the code violations, but this fatal North Carolina blaze had previous violations. And so this is not only the new things, but getting our firefighters involved in the codes process and our fire chiefs and fire marshals involved in setting those code processes, because that's what we're going to do here in September when it comes Minneapolis time, being involved in the International Code Council hearings. We'll go to NFPA. Of course, that's the NFPA codes require fire sprinklers in 1 and 2 family dwellings.
You know, so one of the, Bruno Cini here, one of the problems is that we don't operate on the fire ground much different based on how that building was, let me do a structure fire, based on how that building was built in relation to a code or how it has been maintained. In other words, part of the problem, I think, is that we have not translated in terms that people can understand what we can and what we can't do. That's been enough of a problem inside the fire service, much less trying to connect to the general world outside the fire service. But and this may be one of the places where we could get more interest from firefighters if we translated what we're talking about here this morning into tactical terms. And I wasn't being facetious or mean-spirited when I said it. I didn't mean it that way. It's to say that building is going to behave and operate and ultimately is either going to live or die based on the code that it was built under. Now, and Chief Buckman said it, is how do you answer the woman, the relative of that firefighter, when she asks, what were we doing in there? See, we can't answer that question. So what we do is we wrap ourselves in a flag because we want to get through that moment very appropriately. But we ought to explain to the body politic, this is what we can do and this is what we can't do. We did it with high-rise. And we said, if you have 14,000 square foot floor areas, we can't put the fire out from a 40-inch doorway. We cannot put a fire out essentially in a high-rise setting with manual fire suppression if it is beyond almost the incipient stages of that fire. But the fire service is very, very uneasy about saying that these are the things that we simply can't do. Now, we have firefighters. You said it here. One of the panelists said it. Firefighters get killed in buildings where the stairways are destroyed, and we think that we're doing offensive rescue operations. That's crazy. If it's burning the stairways up, what happened to the occupants way before we got involved in it? And I know that we don't like to even talk about this, but to say, and maybe the way that we sort of loop back around is to say the code has a tactical significance to what we can and can't do. It's just that simple. And that's reality therapy that firefighters, and I'm happy that we are such optimists. In other words, when we get on that fire truck, we're going to go out and we are going to make a difference in a positive kind of way. Sometimes it is simply impossible to do that. And that's a tough reality for us.
It is. And, you know, Chief, Shonda Crane here, along those lines, we have a couple of, we have an on-duty assistant chief that's in, you know, responds to all working fires. And one has, you know, a reputation of pulling people out early because he was involved in a situation where he almost lost 12 people because a building had been renovated and the type of construction had been changed. Well, that made an impact on his decision-making in the future, and he has said, I am not going to lose anybody on my watch. Now, some guys interpret that in a negative sense, whereas we should be applauding that and saying, you know, risk versus reward decision-making. If you're deciding that it's not worth someone's life to save that building, that's not a weak decision. It's a responsible
decision. John, if your son was a firefighter, would you want him to work for him?
Yes.
And I think ultimately what
Me
the
too.
Sprinklers do, and Ruben here, is to provide that cushion, if you will, or to give us at least a little bit more time to process that information. I think one way that firefighters would get very involved with the codes and the whole code process is what Chief Brunicini and Chief DeCrane just described, is if it's done in a tactical way or setting. Unfortunately, I've been to probably two or three buildings, large buildings, that were 13D or 13R dwelling or residential. The last one was a very, very large apartment house. The fire occurred on the top floor between the cock loft space and the roof. It burned the roof out first. The sprinkler systems failed inside the building, and we summarily probably had about a $13 million fire. So that's a whole other element that I think you have to process in specifically from the tactical standpoint. And I think that's the area that firefighters have the greatest interest in anyhow. And, again, I don't think anybody on the phone line would be able to point out a case where firefighters have openly come out in any way against changing the code or making sprinklers requirements or being more stringent. In fact, I think just the reverse has happened over the years where they've supported it. But I think the best way to get them directly involved, that the rank-and-file everyday firefighter, and they're the best in the country, and I know that, in all of society, but that would be for it to tie in somehow in a residential process or a tactical process, rather.
Yeah, Chief Rubin, and I know one of the when we look at these tests that underwriters laboratories are doing, I had the opportunity to observe one of those tests, and the 9 test burns that they completed. I'd like to ask Bob. I think this may be where we're going with this, and if as we meet to talk about training, as we talk about the findings, as we look at how this relates to some needed code changes that I know Chief DeCrane's been involved in the codes making process. When we look at these UL tests, and the one I witnessed, for example, was a test assembly of some glue lam truss construction, and what a difference it makes when you protect it with drywall versus not. Bob, you want to talk about that project and the test and how you see maybe we can work that into where we're going with this?
Yeah, thanks. One of the things, you know, we're trying to do is, I think, take, you know, small steps. And that's an important piece that I want to make sure everybody understands is we're not trying to replicate what's going on out in the field and in a fashion where you could just take this data and run with it and say, okay, this is the final nth degree of a study, and now we know the answers. What we're doing is we're developing, I think, and it's been mentioned a couple times in this, what I've heard today, is maybe some information on timelines and time information. And I know everybody kind of works through that in their SOPs, but what's really happening to the construction features in a building when they're exposed to high temperatures over time? And initially, the first few tests that we conducted, we tried to replicate maybe what was built back in the 40s, 50s, you know, lath and plaster and some of the old-style construction features, and just trying to figure out, okay, what's happening once they're exposed to a time temperature curve, standard fire design for construction features. And then we moved on into what I would consider is the old, you know, sod lumber type approach, the dimensional lumber that we see in the 60s and 70s. And what happened, you know, during the same exact test, same size, same scenarios. And finally, and I think this is where you came in, we did test different types of wood trusses then, again, using the same format. And what we're trying to do is just show those simple comparisons between those designs, what's happened, maybe in what people used to, you know, the old timers that were on the truck in the days of open cabs and driving on the back, you know, maybe their experiences to what's happening today in that same type of construction. Now, again, I think this is the baby steps, because I think there's so many more components that will happen, and it's been talked about today. What are we putting into our homes? What are we loading it with? How many ignition sources have we added compared to what we used to build? How are we, even if we do provide any kind of a barrier, not required by code, but let's say just for aesthetic reasons or energy savings reasons, we put drywall on the buildings or on the ceilings, all the the punctures, the holes that we're putting in for, you know, all different types of amenities that we need and are used to now in our homes. Those things are all added up into this timeline that I think is getting shorter. So if we experience a home fire, the timeline from first bell to arriving to be able to do any kind of attack, I think the fires have reached a max earlier. They're exposing the building components earlier. And again, I think it's a combination of we need to know about it earlier if we can. Can we protect it in place? And then obviously sprinklers and the early reaction of sprinklers. And you all supports that effort. You know, Shane and I both sit on the International Fire Code Committee together, and we talked during those meetings about that effort. And so I think that's going to continue on, and the technology keeps changing. But these are the few steps that we're starting to take that we can now, I think, put into some kind of a pictorial time frame idea that this is what's happening and to be cautious. And I think that's going to hopefully open some eyes to take the next steps, because there are next steps to come.
Thank you, Bob. And we've talked about that with the Chief Brunicini said about the thermal insults getting so much worse. And Chief Rubin talked about the strategy and tactics involved. And I think Chief DeCrane's hit on the fact of our biggest challenge is here and what to do, especially with this UL information, is how do we educate the fire service? How do we educate the homeowners in that there is consequences here? So as we wrap this up, I'd like to just go around and get the thoughts of everyone about where we go from here, maybe, and what your thoughts are. Brucini?
Well, I think keep on keeping on. I'm encouraged when I see what's going on, when I see the younger people who are interested in it, who have a long time to go, are going to make, I think, a terrific impact. I think we're seeing examples of what we've talked about here this morning that are substantive improvements in just simply the way we operate and the way we protect our people and the way we protect our customers. So, you know, it's like I said, you know, we started in 1736, and we're trying to parallel park the Queen Mary, and that's a challenging thing for us to do. So, no, I think we're on the right track. We just got to keep going.
Chief Rubin?
You know, the thing I would believe I'd want to add is don't go it alone. The fire chiefs that are listening in, the union presidents, the folks that are in leadership roles across the country, please remember there are some great helps out there as we move towards the process in Atlanta. Shane, you were wonderful. Chief Dalton showed up on a regular basis. I had Chief Dave Hilton in my backyard. I talked to Chief Brunicini once or twice a week. In other words, there's a collective tremendous amount of experience how to get your nose under the door or under the tent, I guess, at City Hall and how to begin having some impact and try to make sense as you move forward in a process that sometimes doesn't seem to make sense. And, of course, I'm talking about the local ordinance process in America. So don't think that you're completely by yourself, and don't think that other folks hadn't gone over that waterfall before, because, quite frankly, they have.
Thank you, Chief Rubin. Chief Buckman?
Oh, thank you, Shane. I think it's we change the future. We don't change the past. We need fire chiefs, firefighters, big, small fire departments, all thinking about the future. How are we going to impact the future? How do we develop those partners, as Chief Rubin said, that will help us change our community's future, change our firefighters' future? We will learn from the past, and hopefully we will take those lessons and we will apply them to the future. But let's think about how we change the future and encourage our people to keep trying. And as I think Dennis, again, Chief Rubin said, let's keep on moving.
Thank you, Chief Bugman. Chief DeCrane?
Yeah, just to follow up on a couple of comments there. I think the one thing, I think Chief Rubin mentioned it earlier, that to bring this into a tactical sense that firefighters have more buy-in to the code. One thing that was said to me in Rochester at the final code action there, one of the consultants was maybe a little threatened by the fire service getting involved. And he made a comment that the fire service needs to understand that we stand in the back of the room and let the experts work on the codes. And it got me to thinking that he's exactly right. The experts should be involved in the code, and there are no better experts out there on buildings that are affected by fire than firefighters.
Here,
and we don't have to get into technical arguments or debates with the consultants and the industry people at the building code hearings. What we need to do is just bring in our real-life experience. What do we see? What have we experienced? What is the real world? How is it affecting us? We take that to the microphone, and real-world experience takes over technical arguments all of the time. We don't have to be intimidated by the process, whether it's locally or whether it's nationally. And like Chief Rubin also said, you don't have to go it alone. I know the EI chiefs are working on organizing a little bit better. There are volunteer organizations that are active in the codes. The IFF has been active, and we're trying to organize ourselves better. But reach out. If you're unsure of something, everyone's here to help.
Thank you, Chief DeCrane. Bob, you brought up a lot of good points, especially something that's near and dear to me that I hit at a lot out on the road, is the fact that the interior fire environment is much different. And I know UL helps us. I got to witness some other tests that were going on there, particularly concerning the amount of fuel load. And I say you take my house in 1950, I might have had a 1 megawatt fire versus today, and I probably got enough stuff in there to have a 5. What are we looking for from UL in the future?
Well, one of the big things is use UL. We're out there. The department I work for is called Regulatory Services, and that's truly what we are. We're there to service you, the regulators. And so use us as your contact and your point person with UL. That's what our staff is available, and all the disciplines of construction are covered. But the one thing I would do want to really push is right now our management team gets together and they're discussing these issues in a bigger, broader view globally. And one of the things that has come from that is these grants and for us to start doing this type of work. What we need is suggestions from you, the firefighters in the field, the fire chiefs in the field. What are you seeing? What things start to send, you know, the hair in the back of your heads up? And tell us about that so that maybe we can find a way to take that and put that into the test labs, into the environments that are controlled so that we can start to see the differences. And maybe future grants will come our way that we can work on those with you and bring in more items. So, again, use us. We're available. And feel free to contact us as a partner.
Good. Thank you, Bob. Well, I appreciate all you fine folks being here today with us. I appreciate firehouse.com. Most of all, I'd like to say a special thanks to the National Fire Sprinkler Association for their sponsorship on these sessions. And there will be two more podcasts coming up that follow this, one in July and one in August. The one in July is going to be conducted by the Common Voices Coalition, which will there's folks involved in Common Voices who have been directly affected by fire, who have lost loved ones. The other is going to be the IFC's Fire and Life Safety Section. We're going to talk about getting involved in the codes process to make a difference. We got the vote coming up in September involving the ICC Coalition, the code process, particularly the inclusion of residential fire sprinklers in the International Residential Code. So again, that's in September. Those hearings are in Minneapolis. Everyone can visit the IRCfiresprinkler.org to get travel stipend information and how to get involved in that process. So to sum this up, again, as Chief Buckman said about the capabilities, that's where we are in a setting. If we can't provide the capabilities, we got to look at protecting our firefighters, as Chief Brunicini so eloquently started us off. We need to put that protection in place. And as a fire chief, if we can't provide adequate resources and the body politic makes the decision not to deploy adequate resources in the street, then what's our options? And there's other options in community fire protection other than just total deployment after the event. So it's time for the fire service to take action, and it's time to make a difference in our communities and our nation. And again, a special thanks to all those involved here, and I look forward to working with you for many more years to fix this problem. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Shane.
Thank you, Shane.
Of the 3,000-plus fire deaths each year, tragically, most occur in the place where most people feel the safest, in their own homes. But a practical, cost-effective solution is available: residential fire sprinkler systems. As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to ask every member of the International Code Council to vote in favor of including residential fire sprinkler requirements in the body of the International Residential Code at the upcoming final code hearings in Minneapolis. Residential fire sprinklers are a proven life safety technology whose time has come. Let's get them installed where they will do the most good.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.